The following program is an abridged audio version of the streaming video talk show, A Wonderful Chaos. The hosts are Andy Chaliff and Bambos Dimitriou. The format is entirely casual, unscripted conversation. If you'd like to watch a live taping or participate with your comments in real time, subscribe to A Wonderful Chaos on YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, or Twitch.
It was my real ticket out, and that I'm grateful for. But it had I not had parents who had me at that age, I wouldn't have found that 94-foot box to hide in for most of my life.
It's a wonderful chaos. Two, three, random, messy and glorious.
Solo or tandem?
We work to find rest and fight to find peace. Both head and the heart.
Show
where the more that you learn is the less that you know, where the wounded are healers
and the atheists pray.
It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos.
We never get bored of this tune, do we?
No, we never get bored of it.
Never.
Today we're on with Sean Opinui. And Sean Opinui,
he's a splendid chap.
He is. He's a former NBA basketball player.
Really?
Yes, he made it to the NBA. And I spoke to him and he told me in the most casual of ways that his parents had him when they were 13 years old. And it knocked me off my socks. So we're going to talk to him about being raised pretty much by yourself. And I'm loving the And It's Fucking Great group. Like every day I get a smile on my face. Just how cool is it? I think there's between 30 and 40 posts a day of people celebrating things that are just not easy for them to make peace with. And how cool is that?
Yeah. I actually used it today during the photo shoot with my the first client of the day. She said, I always look insecure in photographs. I've never had a good picture of myself. Uh-huh. And I said to her, can you say that again? Uh-huh. I look insecure in my images and it's fucking great. And like every time she had a block, and it's fucking great. And she kept on
opening up.
Yeah. So now she left with the feeling of, oh, I'm going to have a problem picking pictures.
Oh, nice.
So yeah. It wasn't the hair. It was really her embracing and laughing at it.
I love it. One thing I've seen with the And It's Fucking Great hashtag thing is that I've noticed that, like, Mariana, I don't know if you saw, she posted something beautiful today. It was one post to the next post to the next post. So I did a radio show that'll be on Tuesday. And the person said to me, okay, so I'm going to reclaim something. They said, I'm not happy with how I look, and it's fucking great. And then they said, well, what do I do when I'm not feeling like I'm doing this right? And I said, how about saying, I don't feel like I'm doing this right, and it's fucking great. And then she just started to laugh because she saw that the idea of judging the other thing was the freedom that she could get. And there was this sort of, what I've noticed is that it continues further and further. And it's not the one statement. It's the judgment of the fact that you're not even capable of making peace with that statement. All of it is of course to be celebrated. So I found that really sweet. And I see it evolving.
Thank you.
Only question I'm not exactly sure of at the moment is the private or public. We've kept it as a public group, especially following from our kind of the man who really was the brainchild behind it was Bolalang. And I really felt like his vision was to make it a public arena. And I've noticed that some people, because it's public, are having a hard time publishing. So I'm trying to think about how to address that.
Well,
now.
Think about it now. If people need it to be private, then it's not fucking great.
That's what Bolalang would suggest. I'd love to talk about it. We can talk about it on or off air at some point, but I'd like to think about there's an anonymous publishing so that people who might have friends don't want them necessarily to see certain things. Like, I hate my manager and it's fucking great. Like, that might not be the best thing to state on the open public thing So getting to our guest, Sean Opinui. Sean came through a mutual friend who was also on the show, who also was the editor of both books, Stephen Palmer. We did a show with him as My Dad is a Narcissist. He came up with that title, not me. you know, their mutual friend, they're doing a basketball website together that teaches people how to play basketball well. And I got in contact with Sean, and Steven said, do me a favor, have a talk with my friend Sean. And I talked to Sean, and then I said, like, so Sean, tell me a bit about yourself. And then Sean just says, oh yeah, well, I was born and raised in Hawaii. And yeah, my parents had me when I was when they were 13 years old. And then he continued on for like 3 minutes. But once he said, my parents had me when they were 13 years old, like my whole brain froze. Like anything he said after that was just like a murmur. And then I thought, hold on, your parents had you when you were 13, when they were 13 years old? And then my brain couldn't reconcile what would that life look like. And I also had the feeling for Sean, it was so normal that he didn't actually think it was anything strange for the, you know, because he was raised in it. It was just normal for him. And I was sitting in awe, like, you know, how is it that, you know, you remember going to your parents' high school graduation? Like, on what planet is that? You know, I didn't have, so.
If they graduated.
They graduated high school. That's what at least, but we'll get into that with him. So with that, I just wanted to have him on and just discuss how it felt. And he really spent a lot of time kind of raising himself on the beach. And I thought, what an incredible life. And he took that and he found the thing, as we've seen in life, the thing he was damn good at, which was basketball. He made it, played college basketball, and then finally eventually made it into the NBA, which is miraculous, you know, because so few people make it into the NBA. So I thought that would be cool to bring him on to discuss this.
Okay. Let's bring him on.
Here he is. Hello.
Hey, guys.
You're one of these people, and there's a lot of you, by the way, that come kicking and screaming onto the show. Like, I'll ask him one time, say, will you be on the show? And they say, let me think about it. Then the second time, they're like, oh, I guess. And then the third time, it's almost like it's hard to say no anymore.
You know, anytime I can steal time with you, Andy, I'm going to take advantage of it. It's a blessing for me.
Thank you, brother. Tell me, when you hear me share how I experience you telling me this story, what happens for you when you hear me describe that?
I was laughing. I guess I'm just full of joy with it now. I bore that burden for so long and finally was able to let all that shit go.
Yeah.
And literally, it is fucking great. It's fucking great.
But I mean, like, I'm curious, at what time or what point in your life did you realize that your parents were such an almost so close to your age, it was sort of almost, it was strange?
It still happens. It's just in daily conversations with my parents, it's a different paradigm. I find myself not sure what to call them. Do I call them mom and dad? Do I call them by their first name? You know, at this point, it's fun. It's a great blessing. I have friends that I get to grow up with since childhood. Now I guess how I look at it.
Yeah. Like, take us back to, cause at some point when you were young, you must have thought to yourself, there's something that's not similar to the other friends around me.
That, you know, that didn't happen until I was older. I think once I was on the mainland, until I was at a friend's house and I saw like a connective family unit and the connective parents, and it was like, oh, that's what the other side looks at. But with all due respect to my parents, I mean, they did the best they absolutely knew how to do at all fucking times. Yeah. And there's nothing but love for them at that.
Yeah, yeah. This isn't to trash them. It's more like to understand your life.
You know, you mentioned Steve Ballmer. He always uses the phrase, the water in which we swim, the water in which we swim. And it was just water, which I was just swimming, trying to stay afloat. I didn't realize anything until it was probably teenagers, probably about 15, 16.
It's 15 or 16, you realize something might be a little bit different.
Yeah. And then it punched me in the face when I had my first child. And then it was, okay.
Like, you, what happened then?
My whole paradigm changed. As soon as I had my first child, Mia, I remember, you know, just holding it for the first time and saying, I'm going to be the greatest parent in the world. And I know the blueprint, what not to do. And now I get to kind of break this barrier and start over and start a whole new route for her and her kids.
But in a way, you didn't have a model to base it on. In some ways, it wasn't like you could say, oh, I know how my parents did it, so I'm just going to do it that way. You had to figure out how to do it yourself.
Absolutely. I think it's helped my parenting now. I have three kids now. My daughter I spoke of is now 14, and I have twins that are 11. And we communicate to each other like friends and companions and not dad. And I still play that role, but in the role they want me to play it in. And so it helped me just kind of break that paradigm shift that unfortunately my culture is known for. And I get to start fresh.
How is it to look at your 14-year-old daughter and think to yourself that she is the age that your parents were?
Oh, it's nuts. It's nuts. My 11-year-old twin just got asked out on her first date 2 days ago. And so that, it's funny you say that, because that paradigm for me kind of hit me like, oh shit. Like, at this point, they could have a child. You know, at this point, my process could start all over again.
Yeah. How do you withhold that? Because I think a lot of people get so anxious from, you know, so my mom, like, she had two rules. It was no drunk driving and use a condom, right? Those are the two rules in the house. And those were like,
that's smart.
Sacrosanct. No drunk driving. It's like two things. One, you're going to either kill yourself, or two, you're going to be stuck with something potentially the rest of your life you don't want. Those were her rules.
Right.
And so I can imagine, and I know that came a lot from obviously not wanting to lose me and having some people in her environment that also had drunk driving, you know, deaths around, and the fact that she got my eldest brother was an unintended birth, and she didn't want me to be in the same situation.
Andy, can I just pause really fast? I'm going to steal some strength from you because I know your story. I mean, and you can just say your mom's rule was no drunk driving.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Man, you're fucking strong.
I never made that connection.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah, when she died, I really lost the only person in my life I felt that I could rely on.
And it was one of those rules.
Yeah, and it was one of those rules. Nah. I remember after, in the autopsy it was kind of shitty because after she died, since she was killed by this woman who then drove away, it was a hit and run and there was a big court case. And I remember going into the defense attorney at the time. And because the woman who killed my mom had an injunction put on me because she said I was stalking her.
Oh, so
not only was it the shit of the trial, but I also had someone knock on my door, a lawyer, say, hey, we're putting some kind of injunction on you, right? Which I kind of thought was, after you've lost everything that meant something to you, something like that means nothing to you. You just kind of laugh because I didn't know the woman or anything about her. But when I went in, there was they didn't take so many precautions, and there were all the autopsy pictures of my mom on the table. So it was like, so you walk in and you're looking, and then you see the remnants of the thing you loved, just, you know, on the table. They moved it quickly. Obviously, at some point they saw someone probably was given a speaking to afterwards. But I remember them talking that they had to, like, because they had to make sure my mom wasn't drunk, because then if she were drunk, then so. And the only way they could do that, I heard, was by basically taking a syringe and sort of taking fluid out of her eye. Because in some way, I wasn't aware of that. But those are all the things that, you know, you hear as a young adult, and you're trying to integrate that when emotionally, you know, you're having a hard time feeling anything. So, yeah.
Fuck, I love you, man.
Yeah. Love you too, man. Yeah. Yeah. So getting back to you. tell us about, like, how it was to be, like, you as a kid. Like, share, go back and let us kind of help us understand, how does that life look? And also the background of it, because I think, you know, I said you were in Hawaii, but I don't know, like, if there's a cultural thing that also I have not never really understood, that it might even be kind of normal to have to be a child of a 13-year-old. Because I've never been in an environment where that would even be halfway normal.
I think in that cultural situation, we grew up in the lower poverty state. And so in that kind of a situation, from the gate, it's eat or be eaten type of world. It's fend for yourself from the get-go. So, I locked myself up in a 94-foot area of that basketball court, and I ran. I mentally ran, I emotionally ran, I physically ran, and just lived there until I could leave. And that was my space. So when you ask the question, you know, what I had to mentally, emotionally, physically check out into that 94-foot box just to not be eaten.
And what age were you when that box became your home?
Four.
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 At four, you began playing basketball.
At four, at four. Yeah. And then I wouldn't, I mean, it was my safety net. You know, I didn't want to leave my safety net. It was the only place where those dangers couldn't touch me. I'm Polynesian. We all are supposed to play football. We're all supposed to be big. And I'm barely 150 pounds, so football wasn't my gig. So that 94-foot box, no one was there.
Wow. It reminds me, without the torturous part of it, of like when I was good in track, it was the first time I felt like I belonged to anything, or that I actually had any comfort or strength or self-assurance, self-confidence.
That's interesting you say that. That was your strength, that track.
Yeah.
And then forgive me if I keep pulling back, but when your story touched me so much, you received your news.
Was it
the safety and that strength that you just described right there? That's fucking rad.
Yeah. When I did the trip, I went back to the same place where it happened. And I didn't, you know, now if I go back, it's really emotional, but I didn't have any inkling that allowing myself to go back and sort of not putting any barriers up, how hard it would be to be there again. And to be there kind of alone in a way. In this, I was physically alone, but it was like there was nothing that had changed in that whole area that would have made it feel any different. It wasn't like I could have looked at someone and said, oh, it's so different. It was really the exact same place. So to have experience, to go back into that feeling again was overwhelming, actually. It was really, I had to kind of go, because there was also people on the track field running and doing their thing. And when I lost it, I kind of had to go to a shelter, because I thought, you know, they don't know what's going on, and they just see some crazy man kind of bawling on the middle of the field, which wouldn't have been a big problem, but yeah.
That's most of my day, I think. That was just some crazy dreaded man just bawling about something.
Yeah. How is that for you? Because in a way, that's when I feel most alive, and I'm wondering on your case, how do you feel in there?
I fucking love it.
Yeah.
I love it. I, uh, I want nothing more than just to connect on these levels and be vulnerable and share back and forth. Yeah. I love it.
Mm.
I'm surrounded by good people who share the same thoughts. You know, I have, you mentioned Steve Palmer. His wife is one of the greatest entrepreneurs I've ever met. I get to her in my circle. I have people like you. I'm very blessed where I'm at. I'm grateful. I love just being in your presence and just feeling and it's empowering for me. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I was really, you know, you saw, I think it's kind of funny because like I mentioned on the start of the show, when we told this, when we were speaking and you gave me that detail and you kept talking and I kept pulling you back to that detail and you kept like thinking, I don't know, you were like, yeah, we've already gotten past that, Andy. And I kept saying, Sean, they were 13 fucking years old. I think I said it to you, like, how does that not impact you, you know?
It impacted me growing up to what I didn't want to do. I had my own kind of rules that I established in my brain, especially in that aspect of this is not what I'm going to do. This is not how I'm going to start my little family. This is not what I'm going to put them into. So it impacted me, I think, as a kid in a negative way, but it didn't, because it pushed me into an area that I fell in love with and it pushed me into what my core beliefs are now. And so it was such a positive thing that I would never be in this situation if my core beliefs had I not been blessed for that opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the key of life, is that it's like, you know, the clam where you have the tension, which is that dirt that comes in, then it's turned into the pearl.
Right.
Like that's the journey. And some people are able to make it into a pearl, and some people it just stays that irritant their entire lives.
It's absolutely the biggest pearl for me.
Yeah.
To have had that experience and to have that trial, I guess, or just that opportunity to say, okay, I know where I'm going.
The one thing we'll talk about a lot on the show in general is like, limiting beliefs and things that you would have had to overcome in order to make more and more peace. You know, there's always been another thing you can make peace with. Is there anything you'd say in your life, you're like, oh, I had to make peace with something in order to like get to the next level, like in sports or anything in that area?
Yeah. It's loneliness.
Mm.
It's been something I grew up with. It's just been with my whole life, and it's still something I had to make peace with in the basketball world. I had to make peace with now as an adult turning 40 without a partner. You know, I thought that would be such a huge blow to me in the sense. And I constantly have to accept and just fucking, I ride on my mirror. I'm alone. It's fucking great. It's constantly something I have to overcome. So it's clearly something that the universe wanted me to learn from a young age, is loneliness.
Yeah. And because I think we discussed it once, even when you went to the NBA, you said you also felt quite lonely there, so as I can remember.
It's a tough world. That basketball world is a tough world. If I may speak just from my heart, I think it's a very narcissistic world. It's about me and look at me and it's a world I have trouble living in. It's the energy, just, it really hurts. And so it was an alone type of a situation. I didn't want to go out with teammates. I didn't want to go live that lifestyle. I stayed in my room.
Wow. And it's interesting because that's followed you, you know, sounds like a constant. If you say your red thread of your life, then right. there is a degree to which it's always, and I would say in my own life, that would be the same red thread.
Same here.
Yeah.
I finally, I think now at the age of 40, have embraced all of it.
Hmm.
Have embraced all of the loneliness, and I love the loneliness.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the, in a weird way, making, you know, when I was in Vienna before I came to the Amsterdam, I couldn't like leave a moment of my time not on the phone. Like I was constantly on the phone, and then every night there was something arranged just because the silence was just too much. Even the weekend. So, I had every night, Monday night was, or Sunday night was movie night. Monday night was squash. Tuesday night was dinner with it. You know, I was like literally my life was programmed out. And that was all to escape the quiet.
Andy, I still run in that manner. I absolutely still run in that manner. God blessed me with really good physical abilities, and I'll work out 6-8 hours a day. I still run from that loneliness in that manner.
Yeah. At least you're moving in a direction which isn't necessarily harmful, I don't hear.
No, I love it. I think it's great. It's so meditative.
Yeah.
It sounded to me that when you were sharing, like when I'm trying to think of a question, I'm looking at myself in my own life because I do see the commonality and how I've used parts of my life as an identity or to be more than what I was to cover up. And somehow when Andy announced you as being as the MB, I'm like, oh, so we have a celebrity. And then, getting to know you in this, last 37 minutes, I realized that possibly was the time in your life where you actually felt maybe even disconnect from yourself.
Absolutely. I used it as a means to an end. Which is what it was there for. But yeah, absolutely.
Would you say that you stopped enjoying playing basketball?
Yes, immediately. Mm-hmm. Immediately. Yeah.
And before that, you were really passionate, I guess.
Loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Fuck.
Absolutely loved it. It was my real ticket out, and I'm grateful for it. But it had I not had parents who had me at that age, I wouldn't have found that 94-foot box to hide in for most of my life.
I remember when my dad kicked me out of the house and said, "You're dead," and out of the will. And, you know, he did the whole number on me. Then my life became, how do I fend for myself? There was fear and there was anxiety. How am I going to do this? And it was quite interesting because I noticed that as I got older, I was deeply grateful that he created that tension because it forced me to make decisions I wouldn't have otherwise made. There was
that
no
comfort zone.
Yeah. The comfort zone was gone. Thankfully, his influence was also gone, which was doubly. So it was like I told him as before he died, that the greatest gift he ever gave me was the gift of, you know, telling me that I was dead to him.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Yeah. Absolutely. My father never told me I was dead. He said, we can't afford to send you to college. We can't afford to do anything. You got to make your own way. And I was 10 years old. 10 years old, like, okay, I got that shit. I got it handled.
At 10 years old, that's what you were being told.
I'm so grateful it wasn't when I was 18. I'm so grateful it was 10 and I had all that time to mentally grasp and take it. I can't imagine being a dad telling that to my 11-year-old. So the strength it took my dad to even say that is a whole nother level of just.
Yeah.
I viewed it as the ultimate gift.
Yeah. Yeah, I always said that my dad could have always said to me, Andy, you know, whatever support, I can't give any support to you because I don't agree with how you're living, but I love you. Like right. that would have been what I would have loved for my dad to have done if he had the social emotional capacity to do that, but he didn't. And actually, I think I was better off because of it, because that meant that I also could, for the first time in my life, create my life and not satisfy another person's idea of what my life should be.
Right.
Yeah. One thing you said, which hit me was, I also know that when I, left in the fear and anxiety of my own trying to take care of myself, I got good in business and I got good in business a bit to escape. So if I do well in business, that means I'm independent and I don't need anybody. And towards the end of that journey, I didn't like who I'd become. So there's that moment when you just look in the mirror and you say, okay, is this the life I want to really be living? And then I met my mentor Case, right? And that was the big life do-over. But as you spoke about it, when I went from Vienna, where I was living then, to Amsterdam, I went from having contact 24/7 to having virtually no contact outside of my contact with Case for about 10 years. I felt as if I was living like a monk. It was like, it takes a long time to build a relationship with yourself.
It does. It does.
Yeah.
Turns out I'm pretty cool.
Yeah. Can we love the kid, or are we going to pretend like that kid doesn't exist and then struggle against it our entire lives?
The fucking kid's rad, I think.
The kid is rad.
I think he's rad.
Yeah. It took me a long time just to love that kid and just fully just laugh at him, make fun of him, right? Just celebrate the hell out of him. But like, that kid would feel really comfortable walking the streets of Amsterdam naked and just enjoying the fact that this whole life and thing is so absurd that everyone here doesn't know they're taking all of this shit way too seriously.
Yeah, no. Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, it's been beautiful to be with you. And one of the things that I love most when I work with someone like you, and I use you as the, and Bombos are very similar for me, is that you're so sensitive to bullshit that you are an incredible mirror for anyone, including for me. Cause if you are triggered, I trust that there's something that you are seeing in me, triggered by me, not by what I say, but by me, that I trust there's something that you are seeing in me that I'm not necessarily in contact with in myself. Do you know how that works with really sensitive people? Intuitively, you don't trust someone, you, right?
My energy radar is very good.
Yes. And so what I'm saying is maybe you haven't honed it, but I trust your energy radar when it comes to our interactions, because I know, oh, he's sensing something that that basically I can learn from. Or what I've seen other people do is they blame people like you and Bombos a lot for how you behave because you're not giving them what they need from you. You both know that from your experiences, of course. So when people blame you, I laugh and think, oh shit, they didn't get the opportunity to learn and grow because they somehow weren't able to ask the question, what is it you see in me that you feel like I'm not necessarily connected to, or what's triggering you about my behavior?
Can you say that question again? That was money. Say that question again.
So the question is, what is it that I'm doing that's triggering you? Or what is it you see in me that you maybe I don't see in myself? So what's the question you're willing to ask that's uncomfortable?
I like that.
Because there's no agenda there. It's only, I'm assuming you're right. I'm giving both of, in your cases, both of you, the agency to already say, I can say whatever I want because I don't hear anyone defending on the other end.
I love that.
Yeah, but people don't do that because they defend, because they think, oh shit, I really don't want to know the answer. It's uncomfortable.
Or it's offensive. Yeah. Or.
But I'll ask the two of you for all the feedback in the world. But you remember in the story in the book, fuck you and your fucking judgment, right? If someone already judges without any self-reflection, then I have very little time for feedback now. If someone is totally saying, hey, I have something to tell you, you made me uncomfortable, but I'm not going to take any responsibility for what it is that maybe was triggered in me that comes from my childhood. It doesn't matter to me. It's only about you. I have so little time for that now in my life. Yeah.
It's such a true statement. So little time.
So little time. Thank you, my friend.
Andy, I love the fuck out of you. Bombos, I love your energy and thank you for sharing it. I feel like this is very much a taking situation for me where I just got to take it, your strength and your energy. And I'm so grateful.
Thank you, man. Love you.
Love you, boys.
He's going to have a good cry right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's beautiful. I love that we get to have the guest on that's most connected and then you're tired.
Well, actually tired and I could let go.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. Yeah. A wonderful chaos.
Apparently so.
We hopefully. And I'll make sure Bambus gets more sleep before the next show. Bye.
It's a wonderful chaos. We like it that.